Severa aureus, he said, touching one small coin that glowed with the deep mellowness of ancient gold from the velvet. And here, a sestertius of the Calpurnia family. His voice was soft and his hand sure, stroking the edge of a silver coin only slightly worn, or cradling one in his palm to demonstrate the weight of it. He looked up from the coins, eyes bright with the reflections of the precious metal. Monsieur Fraser tells me that you desire to inspect as many of the Greek and Roman rarities as possible. I have not my whole stock with me, of course, but I have quite a few, and I could send to Frankfurt for others if you desire.
Jamie smiled, shaking his head.
I'm afraid we haven't time, Mr. Meyer. We... just Meyer, Monsieur Fraser. The young man interrupted, perfectly polite, but with a slight edge in his voice. Indeed.
Jamie bowed slightly.
I hope my cousin shall not have misled you. I shall be most happy to pay the cost of your journey and something for your time. But I'm not wishful to purchase any of your stock myself, Meyer.
The young man's eyebrows rose in inquiry, along with one shoulder.
What a wish,
Jamie said slowly, leaning forward to look closely at the coins on display,
is to compare your stock with my recollection of several ancient coins I have seen, and then, should I see any that are similar, to inquire whether you, or your family, I should say, for I expect you are too young yourself, should be familiar with anyone who might have purchased such coins 20 years ago.
He glanced up at the young Jew, who was looking justifiably astonished, and smiled.
That may be asking a bit much of you, I know. But my cousin tells me that your family is one of the few who deals in such matters, and is by far the most knowledgeable. If you can acquaint me likewise with any persons in the West Indies with interests in this area, I should be deeply obliged to you.
Meyer sat looking at him for a moment, then inclined his head, the sunlight winking from the border of small jet beads that adorned his skullcap. It was plain that he was intensely curious, but he merely touched his pack and said,
"My father or my uncle would have sold such coins, not me, but I have here the catalogue and record of every coin that has passed through our hands in 30 years. I will tell you what I can."
He drew the velvet cloth toward Jamie and sat back.
"Do you see anything here like the coins, remember?"
Jamie studied the rows of coins with close attention, then gently nudged a silver piece about the size of an American quarter. 3 leaping porpoises circled its edge, surrounding a charioteer in the centre.
"This one," he said. "There were several like it. Small differences, but several with these porpoises."
He looked again, picked out a worn gold disc with an indistinct profile, then a silver one, somewhat larger and in better condition, with a man's head shown both full face and in profile.
"These," he said, 14 of the gold ones and 10 of the ones with 2 heads." 10?
Meyer's bright eyes popped wide with astonishment.
"I should not have thought there were so many in Europe."
Jamie nodded.
"I'm quite certain. I saw them closely, handled them even." "These are the twin heads of Alexander,"
Meyer said, touching the coin with reverence.
"Very rare indeed. It is a tetradrachm, struck to commemorate the battle fought at Amphipolis and the founding of a city on the site of the battlefield."
Jamie listened with attention, a slight smile on his lips. While he had no great interest in ancient money himself, he did have a great appreciation for a man with a passion. A quarter of an hour more, another consultation of the catalogue, and the business was complete. 4 Greek drachmas of a type Jamie recognised had been added to the collection, several small gold and silver coins, and a thing called a quintinarius, a Roman coin in heavy gold. Meyer bent and reached into his pack once more, this time pulling out a sheaf of foolscap pages furled into a roll and tied with ribbon. Untied, they showed row upon row of what looked from a distance like bird tracks. On closer inspection, they proved to be Hebraic writing, inked small and precise. He thumbed slowly through the pages, stopping here and there with a murmured, then passing on. At last he laid the pages on his shabby knee and looked up at Jamie, head cocked to one side.
"Our transactions are naturally carried out in confidence, monsieur," he said. "And so while I could tell you, for example, that certainly we had sold such and such a coin in such and such a year, I should not be able to tell you the name of the purchaser."
He paused, evidently thinking, then went on.
"We did, in fact, sell coins of your description. 3 drachmas, 2 each of the heads of Eagle Abelus and the double head of Alexander, and no fewer than 6 of the gold Capernaum aurei in the year 1745.
He hesitated.
"Normally, that is all I could tell you. However, in this case, monsieur, I happen to know that the original buyer of these coins is dead, has been dead for some years, in fact. Really, I cannot see that under the circumstances..."
He shrugged, making up his mind.
"The purchaser was an Englishman, monsieur.
His name was Clarence Marylebone, Duke of Sandringham."
"Sandringham?" I exclaimed, startled into speech. Maya looked curiously at me, then at Jamie, whose face betrayed nothing beyond polite interest.
"Yes, madame," he said. "I knew that the Duke is dead, for he possessed an extensive collection of ancient coins which my uncle bought from his heirs in 1746. The transaction is listed here."
He raised the catalogue slightly and let it fall. I knew the Duke of Sandringham was dead too, and by more immediate experience. Jamie's godfather, Murtagh, had killed him on a dark night in March 1746, soon before the Battle of Culloden brought an end to the Jacobite rebellion. I swallowed briefly, recalling my last sight of the Duke's face, its blueberry eyes fixed in an expression of intense surprise. Maya's eyes went back and forth between us. Then he added hesitantly,
"I can tell you also this. When my uncle purchased the Duke's collection after his death, there were no tetradrams in it."
"No," Jamie murmured to himself.
"There wouldn't have been."
Then, recollecting himself, he stood and reached for the decanter that stood on the sideboard.
"I thank you, Meyer," he said formally. "And now, let us drink to you and your wee book there."
A few minutes later, Meyer was kneeling on the floor, doing up the fastenings of his ragged pack. The small pouch filled with silver leaf that Jamie had given him in payment was in his pocket. He rose and bowed in turn to Jamie and to me before straightening and putting on his disreputable hat.
"I bid you goodbye, madame," he said.
"Goodbye to you, too, Meyer," I replied. Then I asked somewhat hesitantly, "Is Meyer really your only name?" Something flickered in the wide blue eyes, but he answered politely, heaving the heavy sack onto his back.
"Yes, madame. The Jews of Frankfurt are not allowed to use family names."
He looked up and smiled lopsidedly.
"For the sake of convenience, the neighbours call us after an old red shield that was painted on the front of our house many years ago, but beyond that, no, madame, we have no name."
Josephine came then to conduct our visitor to the kitchen, taking care to walk several paces in front of him, her nostrils pinched white as though smelling something foul. Maya stumbled after her, his clumsy sabots clattering on the polished floor. Jamie relaxed in his chair, eyes abstracted in deep thought. I heard the door close downstairs a few minutes later with what was almost a slam, and the click of sabots on the stone steps below. Jamie heard it too and turned toward the window.
"Well, Godspeed to you, Maya Redshield," he said, smiling.
"Jamie," I said, suddenly thinking of something, "do you speak German?"
"Eh?
Oh, aye," he said vaguely, his attention still fixed on the window and the noises outside. "What is Redshield in German?" I asked. He looked blank for a moment,
Then his eyes cleared as his brain made the proper connection.
Rothschild, Sassenach, he said. Why?
Just a thought, I said. I looked toward the window where the clatter of wooden shoes was long since lost in the noises of the street. I suppose everyone has to start somewhere.
15 men on a dead man's chest, I observed. Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum.
Jamie gave me a look.
Why? He said.
The Duke being the dead man, I explained. Do you think the seal's treasure was really his?
I couldn't say for sure, but it seems at least likely.
Jamie's two stiff fingers tapped briefly on the table in a meditative rhythm.
When Jared mentioned Meyer, the coin dealer, to me, I thought it worth inquiring, for surely the most likely person to have sent the Bruja to retrieve the treasure was the person who put it there.
Good reasoning, I said, but evidently it wasn't the same person if it was the Duke who put it there. Do you think the whole treasure amounted to £50,000? Jamie squinted at his reflection in the rounded side of the decanter, considering. Then he picked it up and refilled his glass to assist thought.
Not as metal, no. But did you notice the prices that some of those coins in Meyer's catalogue have sold for?
I did. As much as £1,000 sterling. For a mouldy bit of metal, he said, marvelling. I don't think metal moulds, I said, but I take your point. Anyway, I said, dismissing the question with a wave of my hand, the point here is this. Do you suppose the seal's treasure could have been the £50,000 that the Duke had promised to the Stuarts? In the early days of 1744, when Charles Stuart had been in France, trying to persuade his royal cousin Louis to grant him some sort of support, he had received a ciphered offer from the Duke of Sandringham of £50,000, enough to hire a small army, on condition that he enter England to retake the throne of his ancestors. Whether it had been this offer that finally convinced the vacillating Prince Charles to undertake his doomed excursion, we would never know. It might as easily have been a challenge from someone he was drinking with, or a slight, real or imagined, by his mistress that had sent him to Scotland, with nothing more than 6 companions, 2,000 Dutch broadswords, and several casks of brandy wine with which to charm the Highland chieftains. In any case, the £50,000 had never been received, because the Duke had died before Charles reached England. Another of the speculations that troubled me on sleepless nights was the question of whether that money would have made a difference. If Charles Stuart had received it, would he have taken his ragged Highland army all the way to London, retaken the throne and regained his father's crown? If he had, well, if he had, the Jacobite rebellion might have succeeded. Culloden might not have happened. I should never have gone back through the Circle of Stone. And I and Brianna would likely have both died in childbed and been dust these many years past. Surely 20 years should have been enough to teach me the futility of if. Jamie had been considering, meditatively rubbing the bridge of his nose.
It might have been, he said at last, given a proper market for the coins and gems. You can such things take time to sell. If you must dispose of them quickly, you'll get but a fraction of the price. But given long enough to search out good buyers, aye, it might reach 50,000.
Duncan Carr was a Jacobite, wasn't he? Jamie frowned, nodding.
He was. Aye, it could be. Though God knows it's an awkward kind of fortune to be handing to the commander of an army to pay his troops.
Yes, but it's also small, portable, and easy to hide, I pointed out. And if you were the Duke, and busy committing treason by dealing with the Stuarts, that might be important to you. Sending £50,000 in sterling, with strong boxes and carriages and guards, would attract the hell of a lot more attention than sending one man secretly across the channel with a small wooden box.
Jamie nodded again. Likewise, if you had a collection of such rarities already, it would attract no attention to be acquiring more, and no one would likely notice what coins you had. It would be a simple matter to take out the most valuable, replace them with cheap ones, and no one the wiser. No banker who might talk were you to shift money or land.
He shook his head admiringly.
It's a clever scheme, aye, whoever made it.
He looked up inquiringly at me.
But then, why did Duncan Carr come nearly 10 years after Culloden? And what happened to him? Did he come to leave the fortune on the Silky's Isle then, or to take it away?
And who sent the Bruja now? I finished for him. I shook my head too.
Damned if I know. Perhaps the Duke had a confederate of some sort, but if he did, we don't know who it was.
Jamie sighed, and impatient with sitting for so long, stood up and stretched. He glanced out the window, estimating the height of the sun, his usual method of telling time, whether a clock was handy or not.
Aye, well, we'll have time for speculation once we're at sea. It's near on noon now, and the Paris coach leaves at 3 o'clock.
The apothecary's shop in the Rue de Varenne was gone. In its place were a thriving tavern, a pawnbroker's, and a small goldsmith's shop, crammed companionably cheek by jowl.
"Master Raymond?"
The pawnbroker knitted grizzled brows.
"I have heard of him, madame."
He darted a wary glance at me, suggesting that whatever he had heard hadn't been very admirable.
"But he's been gone for several years. If you are requiring a good apothecary, though, Krasner in the Place d'Allo, or perhaps Madame Verrou near the Tuileries."
He stared with interest at Mr. Willoughby, who accompanied me, then leaned over the counter to address me confidentially.
"Might you be interested in selling your Chinaman, madame? I have a client with a marked taste for the Orient. I could get you a very good price, with no more than the usual commission, I assure you."
Mr. Willoughby, who didn't speak French, was peering with marked contempt at a porcelain jar painted with pheasants done in an Oriental style. "Thank you," I said, "but I think not. I'll try Krasner." Mr. Willoughby had attracted relatively little attention in Havre, a port city teeming with foreigners of every description. On the streets of Paris, wearing a padded jacket over his blue silk pyjamas, and with his queue wrapped several times around his head for convenience, he caused considerable comment. He did, however, prove surprisingly knowledgeable about herbs and medicinal substances. "By J.I.," he told me, picking up a pinch of mustard seed from an open box in Krasner's emporium. "Good for shunyan, kidneys."
"Yes, it is," I said, surprised. "How did you know?"
He allowed his head to roll slightly from side to side, as I had learned was his habit when pleased at being able to astonish someone.
"I know healers one time," was all he said, though,
before turning to point at a basket containing what looked like balls of dried mud.
"Shan Yu,"
he said authoritatively.
"Good. Very good. Cleanse blood. Liver, he work good. No dry skin. Help see. You buy?"
I stepped closer to examine the objects in question and found them to be a particularly homely sort of dried eel, rolled into balls and liberally coated with mud. The price was quite reasonable, though, so to please him, I added two of the nasty things to the basket over my arm. The weather was mild for early December, and we walked back toward Jared's house in the Rue Trimla. The streets were bright with winter sunshine and lively with vendors, beggars, prostitutes, shopgirls, and the other denizens of the poorer part of Paris, all taking advantage of the temporary thaw. At the corner of the Rue du Nord and the Allée des Canards, though, I saw something quite out of the ordinary. A tall, slope-shouldered figure in black frock coat and a round black hat. "Reverend Campbell!" I exclaimed. He whirled about at being so addressed, then, recognising me, bowed and removed his hat.
"Mistress Malcolm," he said, "how most agreeable to see you again."
His eye fell on Mr. Willoughby, and he blinked, features hardening in a stare of disapproval.
"This is Mr. Willoughby," I introduced him. "He's an associate of my husband's,
Mr. Willoughby, the Reverend Archibald Campbell.
Indeed.
The Reverend Campbell normally looked quite austere, but contrived now to look as though he had breakfasted on barbed wire and found it untasty.
I thought that you were sailing from Edinburgh to the West Indies, I said, in hopes of taking his jellied eye off the Chinaman.
It worked. His gaze shifted to me and thawed slightly.
I thank you for your kind inquiries, madam, he said. I still harbour such intentions. However, I had urgent business to transact first in France. I shall be departing from Edinburgh on Thursday week.
And how is your sister? I asked.
He glanced at Mr. Willoughby with dislike, then, taking a step to one side so as to be out of the Chinaman's direct sight, lowered his voice.
She is somewhat improved, I thank you. The draughts you prescribed have been most helpful. She is much calmer and sleeps quite regularly now. I must thank you again for your kind attentions.
That's quite all right, I said. I hope the voyage will agree with her.
We parted with the usual expressions of goodwill, and Mr. Willoughby and I walked down the Rue du Nord back toward Jared's house.
Reverend meaning most holy fella, not true, Mr. Willoughby said after a short silence.
He had the usual Oriental difficulty in pronouncing the letter R, which made the word reverend more than slightly picturesque, but I gathered his meaning well enough.
True,
I said, glancing down at him curiously. He pursed his lips and pushed them in and out, then grunted in a distinctly amused manner.
Not so holy, that reverend fella, he said.
What makes you say so?
He gave me a bright-eyed glance full of shrewdness.
I see him one time, Madame Jeanne's. Not loud talking then. Very quiet then, reverend fella.
Oh, really?
I turned to look back, but the reverend's tall figure had disappeared into the crowd.
Stinking whores,
Mr. Willoughby amplified, making an extremely rude gesture in the vicinity of his crotch in illustration.
Yes, I gathered, I said.
Well, I suppose the flesh is weak now and then, even for Scottish Free Church ministers.
At dinner that night, I mentioned seeing the Reverend, though without adding Mr. Willoughby's remarks about the Reverend's extracurricular activities.
I ought to have asked him where in the West Indies he was going, I said. Not that he's a particularly scintillating companion, but it might be useful to know someone there.
Jared, who was consuming veal patties in a businesslike way, paused to swallow, then said,
"Dinna trouble yourself about that, my dear. I've made up a list for you of useful acquaintances. I've written letters for you to carry to several friends there who will certainly lend you assistance."
He cut another sizable chunk of veal, wiped it through a puddle of wine sauce and chewed it, while looking thoughtfully at Jamie. Having evidently come to a decision of some kind, he swallowed, took a sip of wine, and said in a conversational voice,
"We met on the level, cousin."
I stared at him in bewilderment. But Jamie, after a moment's pause, replied,
"And we parted on the square."
Jared's narrow face broke into a wide smile.
"Ah, that's a help," he said. "I wasn't just sure, I, but I thought it worth the trial. Where were you made?"
"In prison," Jamie replied briefly. "It will be the Inverness Lodge, though."
Jared nodded in satisfaction.
"Aye, well enough. There are lodges on Jamaica and Barbados. I'll have letters for you to the masters there. But the largest lodge is on Trinidad, better than 2,000 members there. If you should need great help in finding the lad, that's where you must ask. Word of everything that happens in the islands comes through that lodge sooner or later."
"Would you care to tell me what you're talking about?" I interrupted. Jamie glanced at me and smiled.
"Freemason Sassenach."
"You're a Mason?" I blurted. "You didn't tell me that."
"He's not meant to," Jared said a bit sharply. "The rites of Freemasonry are secret, known only to the members. I wouldn't have been able to give Jamie an introduction to the Trinidad Lodge had he not been one of us already."
The conversation became general again as Jamie and Jared fell to discussing the provisioning of the Artemis. But I was quiet, concentrating on my own veal. The incident, small as it was, had reminded me of all the things I didn't know about Jamie. At one time, I should have said I knew him as well as one person can know another. Now there would be moments, talking intimately together, falling asleep in the curve of his shoulder, holding him close in the act of love, when I felt I knew him still, his mind and heart as clear to me as the lead crystal of the wine glasses on Jared's table. And others, like now, when I would stumble suddenly over some unsuspected bit of his past, or see him standing still, eyes shrouded with recollections I didn't share. I felt suddenly unsure and alone, hesitating on the brink of the gap between us. Jamie's foot pressed against mine under the table, and he looked across at me with a smile hidden in his eyes. He raised his glass a little, in a silent toast, and I smiled back, feeling obscurely comforted. The gesture brought back a sudden memory of our wedding night, when we had sat beside each other, sipping wine. Strangers, frightened of each other, with nothing between us but a marriage contract and the promise of honesty.
"There are things you maybe canna tell me," he had said. "I will not ask you or force you. But when you do tell me something, let it be the truth. There is nothing between us now but respect, and respect has room for secrets, I think, but not for lies."
I drank deeply from my own glass, feeling the strong bouquet of the wine billow up inside my head and a warm flush heat my cheeks. Jamie's eyes were still fixed on me, ignoring Jared's soliloquy about ship's biscuit and candles. His foot nudged mine in silent inquiry, and I pressed back in answer.
"Aye, I'll see to it in the morning," he said, in reply to a question from Jared. "But for now, cousin, I think I shall retire. It's been a long day."
He pushed back his chair, stood up, and held out his arm to me.
"Will you join me, Claire?"
I stood up, the wine rushing through my limbs, making me feel warm all over and slightly giddy. Our eyes met with a perfect understanding. There was more than respect between us now, and room for all our secrets to be known, in good time.
This ends Disc 21. Voyager, Disc 22.
In the morning, Jamie and Mr. Willoughby went with Jared to complete their errands. I had another errand of my own, one that I preferred to do alone. 20 years ago, there had been two people in Paris whom I cared for deeply. Master Raymond was gone, dead or disappeared. The chances that the other might still be living were slim. But still, I had to see before I left Europe for what might be the last time. With my heart beating erratically, I stepped into Jared's coach and told the coachman to drive to the Hôpital des Anges. The grave was set in the small cemetery reserved for the convent, under the buttresses of the nearby cathedral. Even though the air from the Seine was damp and cold and the day cloudy, the walled cemetery held a soft light, reflected from the blocks of pale limestone that sheltered the small plot from wind. In the winter there were no shrubs or flowers growing, but leafless aspens and larches spread a delicate tracery against the sky, and a deep green moss cradled the stones, thriving despite the cold. It was a small stone, made of a soft white marble. A pair of cherub's wings spread out across the top, sheltering the single word that was the stone's only other decoration. "Faith," it read. I stood looking down at it until my vision blurred. I had brought a flower, a pink tulip. Not the easiest thing to find in Paris in December, but Jared kept a conservatory. I knelt down and laid it on the stone, stroking the soft curve of the petal with a finger, as though it were a baby's cheek. I thought I wouldn't cry, I said a little later. I felt the weight of Mother Hildegard's hand on my head.
Le bon Dieu orders things as he thinks best, she said softly, but he seldom tells us why.
I took a deep breath and wiped my cheeks with a corner of my cloak. It was a long time ago, though. I rose slowly to my feet and turned to find Mother Hildegard watching me with an expression of deep sympathy and interest.
I have noticed, she said slowly, that time does not really exist for mothers with regard to their children. It does not matter greatly how old the child is. In the blink of an eye, the mother can see the child again as it was when it was born, when it learned to walk, as it was at any age, at any time, even when the child is fully grown and a parent itself.
Especially when they're asleep, I said, looking down again at the little white stone. You can always see the baby then.
Ah.
Mother nodded, satisfied.
I thought you had had more children. You have the look somehow.
One more, I glanced at her. And how do you know so much about mothers and children? The small black eyes shone shrewdly under heavy brow ridges, whose sparse hairs had gone quite white.
The old require very little sleep, she said, with a deprecatory shrug. I walk the wards at night sometimes. The patients talk to me.
She had shrunk somewhat with advancing age, and the wide shoulders were slightly bowed, thin as a wire hanger beneath the black serge of her habit. Even so, she was still taller than I, and towered over most of the nuns, more scarecrow-like, but imposing as ever. She carried a walking stick, but strode erect, firm of tread, and with the same piercing eye, using the stick more frequently to prod idlers or direct underlings than to lean on. I blew my nose, and we turned back along the path to the convent. As we walked slowly back, I noticed other small stones set here and there among the larger ones. Are those all children? I asked, a little surprised.
The children of the nuns, she said matter-of-factly.
I gaped at her in astonishment, and she shrugged, elegant and wry as always.
It happens, she said.
She walked a few steps farther, then added,
Not often, of course.
She gestured with her stick around the confines of the cemetery.
This place is reserved for the sisters, a few benefactors of the hôpital, and those they love.
The sisters or the benefactors?
The sisters. Here, you lump!
Mother Hildegard paused in her progress, spotting an orderly leaning idly against the church wall, smoking a pipe. As she berated him in the elegantly vicious court French of her girlhood, I stood back, looking around the tiny cemetery. Against the far wall, but still in consecrated ground, was a row of small stone tablets, each with a single name, Bouton. Below each name was a Roman numeral, 1 through 15. Mother Hildegard's beloved dogs. I glanced at her current companion, the 16th holder of that name. This one was coal black and curly as a Persian lamb. He sat bolt upright at her feet, round eyes fixed on the delinquent orderly, a silent echo of Mother Hildegard's outspoken disapproval. The sisters, and those they love. Mother Hildegard came back, her fierce expression altering at once to the smile that transformed her strong gargoyle features into beauty.
I'm so pleased that you have come again, ma chère, she said. Come inside. I shall find things that may be useful to you on your journey.
Tucking the stick in the crook of her arm, she instead took my forearm for support, grasping it with a warm, bony hand whose skin had grown paper-thin. I had the odd feeling that it wasn't I who supported her, but the other way round. As we turned up into the small yew alley that led to the entrance to the hôpital, I glanced up at her. "I hope you won't think me rude, Mother," I said hesitantly, "but there is one question I wanted to ask you."
83,
she replied promptly. She grinned broadly, showing her long yellow horse's teeth.
"Everyone wants to know,"
she said complacently. She looked back over her shoulder toward the tiny graveyard and lifted one shoulder in a dismissive Gallic shrug.
"Not yet," she said confidently. "Le bon Dieu knows how much work there is still to do."
Chapter 41. We set sail.
It was a cold grey day. There is no other kind in Scotland in December, when the Artemis touched Cape Wrath on the northwest coast. I peered out of the tavern window into a solid grey murk that hid the cliffs along the shore. The place was depressingly reminiscent of the landscape near the Silky's Isle, with the smell of dead seaweed strong in the air, and the crashing of waves so loud as to inhibit conversation, even inside the small pothouse by the wharf. Young Ian had been taken nearly a month before. Now it was past Christmas, and here we were, still in Scotland, no more than a few miles from the Seal's Island. Jamie was striding up and down the dock outside in spite of the cold rain, too restless to stay indoors by the fire. The sea journey from France back to Scotland had been no better for him than the first Channel crossing, and I knew the prospect of 2 or 3 months aboard the Artemis filled him with dread. At the same time, his impatience to be in pursuit of the kidnappers was so acute that any delay filled him with frustration. More than once I had awakened in the middle of the night to find him gone, walking the streets of Le Havre alone. Ironically, this final delay was of his own making. We had touched at Cape Wrath to retrieve Fergus, and with him the small group of smugglers whom Jamie had sent him to fetch before leaving ourselves for Le Havre.
"There's no telling what we shall find in the Indies, Sassenach," Jamie had explained to me. "I dinna mean to go up against a shipload of pirates single-handed, nor yet to fight wi' men I dinna ken alongside me."
The smugglers were all men of the shore, accustomed to boats and the ocean, if not to ships. They would be hired on as part of the Artemis's crew, short-handed in consequence of the late season in which we sailed. Cape Wrath was a small port, with little traffic at this time of year. Besides the Artemis, only a few fishing boats and a ketch were tied up at the wooden wharf. There was a small pothouse, though, in which the crew of the Artemis cheerfully passed their time while waiting, the men, who wouldn't fit inside the house, crouching under the eaves, swilling pots of ale passed to the windows by their comrades indoors. Jamie walked on the shore, coming in only for meals, when he would sit before the fire, the wisps of steam rising from his soggy garments, symptomatic of his increasing aggravation of soul. Fergus was late. No one seemed to mind the wait but Jamie and Jared's captain. Captain Rains, a small, plump, elderly man, spent most of his time on the deck of his ship, keeping one weather eye on the overcast sky and the other on his barometer.
"That's very strong-smelling stuff, Sassenach," Jamie observed during one of his brief visits to the taproom. "What is it?"
"Fresh ginger," I answered, holding up the remains of the root I was grating. "It's the thing most of my herbals say is best for nausea."
"Oh, aye."
He picked up the bowl, sniffed at the contents, and sneezed explosively to the vast amusement of the onlookers.
I snatched back the bowl before he could spill it. "You don't take it like snuff," I said. "You drink it in tea. And I hope to heaven it works, because if it doesn't, we'll be scooping you out of the bilges, if bilges are what I think they are."
"Oh, not to worry, missus,"
one of the older hands assured me, overhearing. "Lots of green hands feel a bit queer-like the first day or two, but usually they come round soon enough. By the third day they've got used to the pitch and roll, and they're up in the rigging, happy as larks."
I glanced at Jamie, who was markedly unlark-like at the moment. Still, this comment seemed to give him some hope, for he brightened a bit, and waved to the harassed serving-maid for a glass of ale.
"It may be so," he said. "Jared said the same, that seasickness doesn't generally last more than a few days, provided the seas aren't too heavy."
He took a small sip of his ale, and then, with growing confidence, a deeper swallow.
I can stand 3 days of it, I suppose.
Late in the afternoon of the second day, 6 men appeared, winding their way along the stony shore on shaggy Highland ponies.
"There's Rayburn in the lead," Jamie said, shading his eyes and squinting to distinguish the identities of the 6 small dots. "Kennedy after him, then Innes. He's missing the left arm, see? And Meldrum. And that'll be MacLeod with him. They always ride together like that." "Is the last man Gordon, then, or Fergus?"
"It must be Gordon," I said, peering over his shoulder at the approaching men, "because he's much too fat to be Fergus."
"Where the devil is Fergus, then?"
Jamie asked Rayburn, once the smugglers had been greeted, introduced to their new shipmates, and sat down to a hot supper and a cheerful glass. Rayburn bobbed his head in response, hastily swallowing the remains of his pasty.
"Well, he said to me as how he'd some business to see to, and would I see to the hiring of the horses, and speak to Meldrum and MacLeod about coming, for they were out with their own boat at the time, and not expected back for a day or two more, and—"
"What business?" Jamie said sharply, but got no more than a shrug in reply. Jamie muttered something under his breath in Gaelic, but returned to his own supper without further comment. The crew being now complete, save Fergus, preparations began in the morning for getting under way. The deck was a scene of organised confusion, with bodies darting to and fro, popping up through hatchways and dropping suddenly out of the rigging like dead flies. Jamie stood near the wheel, keeping out of the way, but lending a hand whenever a matter requiring muscle rather than skill arose. For the most part, though, he simply stood, eyes fixed on the road along the shore.
"We shall have to sail by mid-afternoon or miss the tide," Captain Raines spoke kindly but firmly. "We'll have surly weather in 24 hours. The glass is falling, and I feel it in my neck."
The captain tenderly massaged the part in question, and nodded at the sky, which had gone from pewter to lead grey since early morning.
"I'll not set sail in a storm if I can help it. And if we mean to make the Indies as soon as possible—"
I understand, Captain," Jamie interrupted him. "Of course you must do as seems best."
He stood back to let a bustling seaman go past, and the captain disappeared, issuing orders as he went. As the day wore on, Jamie seemed composed as usual, but I noticed that the stiff fingers fluttered against his thigh more and more often, the only outward sign of worry. And worried he was. Fergus had been with him since the day 20 years before, when Jamie had found him in a Paris brothel and hired him to steal Charles Stuart's letters. More than that, Fergus had lived at Lallybroch since before young Ian was born. The boy had been a younger brother to Fergus, and Jamie the closest thing to a father that Fergus had ever known. I couldn't imagine any business so urgent that it would have kept him from Jamie's side. Neither could Jamie, and his fingers beat a silent tattoo on the wood of the rail. Then it was time, and Jamie turned reluctantly away, tearing his eyes from the empty shore. The hatches were battened, the lines coiled, and several seamen leapt ashore to cast free the mooring hawsers. There were 6 of them, each rope as thick around as my wrist. I put a hand on Jamie's arm in silent sympathy.
"You'd better come down below," I said. "I've got a spirit lamp. I'll brew you some hot ginger tea, and then you—"
The sound of a galloping horse echoed along the shore, the scrunch of hoofbeats on gravel echoing from the cliffside well in advance of its appearance.
"There he is, the wee fool," Jamie said, his relief evident in voice and body.
He turned to Captain Raines, one brow raised in question.
"There's enough of the tide left. Aye, then let's go."
"Cast off,"
the captain bellowed, and the waiting hands sprang into action. The last of the lines tethering us to the piling was slipped free and neatly coiled,
and all around us lines tightened and sails snapped overhead as the bosun ran up and down the deck, bawling orders in a voice like rusty iron. She moves, she stirs. She seems to feel the thrill of life along her keel, I declaimed, delighted to feel the deck quiver beneath my feet as the ship came alive, the energy of all the crew poured into its inanimate hulk, transmuted by the power of the wind-catching sails.
"Oh, God," said Jamie hollowly, feeling the same thing.
He grasped the rail, closed his eyes, and swallowed.
"Mr. Willoughby says he has a cure for seasickness," I said, watching him sympathetically.
"Ah," he said, opening his eyes. "I ken what he means, and if he thinks I'll let him. What the bloody hell?"
I whirled to look, and saw what had caused him to break off. Fergus was on deck, reaching up to help down a girl perched awkwardly above him on the railing, her long blonde hair whipping in the wind. Lyra's daughter, Marsali McKimmy. Before I could speak, Jamie was past me and striding toward the pair.
"What in the name of holy God do you mean by this, you wee coofs?"
he was demanding by the time I'd made my way into earshot through the obstacle course of lines and seamen. He loomed menacingly over the pair, a foot taller than either of them.
"We are married,"
Fergus said, bravely moving in front of Marsali. He looked both scared and excited, his face pale beneath the shock of black hair.
"Married?"
Jamie's hands clenched at his sides, and Fergus took an involuntary step backward, nearly treading on Masali's toes.
"What do you mean, married?"
I assumed this was a rhetorical question, but it wasn't. Jamie's appreciation of the situation had, as usual, outstripped mine by yards, and seized at once upon the salient point.
"Have you bedded her?" he demanded bluntly.
Standing behind him, I couldn't see his face, but I knew what it must look like, if only because I could see the effect of his expression on Fergus. The Frenchman turned a couple of shades paler and licked his lips.
"No, milor,"
he said, just as Marsali, eyes blazing, thrust her chin up and said defiantly, "Yes, he has." Jamie glanced briefly back and forth between the two of them, snorted loudly, and turned away.
"Mr. Warren,"
he called down the deck to the ship's sailing master,
"put back to the shore, if you please."
Mr. Warren stopped, open-mouthed in the middle of an order addressed to the rigging, and stared, first at Jamie, then, quite elaborately, at the receding shoreline. In the few moments since the appearance of the putative newlyweds, the Artemis had moved more than 1,000 yards from the shore, and the rocks of the cliffs were slipping by with increasing speed.
"I don't believe he can," I said. "I think we're already in the tide race."
No sailor himself, Jamie had spent sufficient time in the company of seamen at least to understand the notion that time and tide wait for no one. He breathed through his teeth for a moment, then jerked his head toward the ladder that led below decks.
"Come down, then, the both of you."
Fergus and Marsali sat together in the tiny cabin, huddled on one berth, hands clutched tight. Jamie waved me to a seat on the other berth, then turned to the pair, hands on his hips.
"Now then," he said, "what's this nonsense of being married?"
"It is true, milor," Fergus said.
He was quite pale, but his dark eyes were bright with excitement. His one hand tightened on Masali's, his hook resting across his thigh.
"Aye,"
Jamie said with a maximum of scepticism.
"And who married you?"
The two glanced at each other, and Fergus licked his lips briefly before replying.
We are handfast."
"Before witnesses?" Marsali put in.
In contrast to Fergus's paleness, a high colour burned in her cheeks. She had her mother's rose-leaf skin, but the stubborn set of her jaw had likely come from somewhere else. She put a hand to her bosom, where something crackled under the fabric.
"I hear the contract and the signatures here."
Jamie made a low growling noise in his throat.
By the laws of Scotland, two people could, in fact, be legally married by clasping hands before witnesses, hand-fasting, and declaring themselves to be man and wife.
"Aye, well," he said, "but you're no bedded yet, and a contract's not enough in the eyes of the church."
He glanced out of the stern casement, where the cliffs were just visible through the ragged mist, then nodded with decision.
"We'll stop at Lewis for the last provisions. Massali will go ashore there. I'll send two seamen to see her home to her mother."
"You'll do no such thing," Massali cried.
She sat up straight, glaring at her stepfather. "I'm going with Fergus."
"Oh, no, you're not, my lassie," Jamie snapped. "Do you have no feeling for your mother? To run off with no word and leave her to be worried."
"I left word."
Massali's square chin was high.
"I sent a letter from Inverness saying I'd married Fergus and was off to sail with you."
"Sweet bleeding Jesus. She'll think I kent all about it."
Jamie looked horror-stricken.
"I did ask the Lady Lyra for the honour of her daughter's hand, milor,"
Fergus put in,
"last month when I came to Lallybroch." "Aye, well, you needna tell me what she said,"
Jamie said dryly, seeing the sudden flush on Fergus's cheeks.
"Since I gather the general answer was no."
"She said he was a bastard,"
Massali burst out indignantly.
"And a criminal, and...
"He is a bastard and a criminal," Jamie pointed out. "And a cripple with no property either, as I'm sure your mother noticed."
"I dinna care."
Massali grasped Fergus's hand and looked at him with fierce affection.
"I want him."
Taken aback, Jamie rubbed a finger across his lips. Then he took a deep breath and returned to the attack.
"Be that as it may," he said, "you're too young to be married."
"I'm 15. That's plenty old enough."
"Aye, and he's 30,
Jamie snapped. He shook his head.
"Nay, lassie, I'm sorry about it, but I canna let you do it. If it were nothing else, the voyage is too dangerous."
"You're taking her?"
Massali's chin jerked contemptuously in my direction.
"You'll leave Claire out of this,"
Jamie said evenly.
"She's none of your concern, and..."
"Oh, she's not? You leave my mother for this English whore and make her a laughing stock for the whole countryside, and it's no my concern, is it?"
Massali leapt up and stamped her foot on the deck.
"And you hae the hellish nerve to tell me what I shall do?"
"I have," Jamie said, keeping hold of his temper with some difficulty. "My private affairs are not your concern."
"And mine aren't any of yours."
Fergus, looking alarmed, was on his feet, trying to calm the girl.
"Massali, ma chère, you must not speak to milor in such a way. He is only..."
"I'll speak to him any way I want."
"No, you will not."
Surprised at the sudden harshness in Fergus's tone, Massali blinked. Only an inch or two taller than his new wife, the Frenchman had a certain wiry authority that made him seem much bigger than he was.
"Non," he said more softly. "Sit down, ma petite."
He pressed her back down on the berth and stood before her.
"Milor has been to me more than a father," he said gently to the girl. "I owe him my life 1,000 times. He's also your stepfather. However your mother may regard him, he has without doubt supported and sheltered her and you and your sister. You owe him respect, at the least."
Massali bit her lip, her eyes bright. Finally, she ducked her head awkwardly at Jamie.
"I'm sorry," she murmured,
and the air of tension in the cabin lessened slightly.
"That's all right, lassie,"
Jamie said gruffly. He looked at her and sighed.
"But still, Massali, we must send you back to your mother."
"I won't go."
The girl was calmer now, but the set of her pointed chin was the same. She glanced at Fergus, then at Jamie.
"He says we haven't bedded together, but we have. Or at any rate, I shall say we have. If you send me home, I'll tell everyone that he's had me. So you see, I shall either be married or ruined."
Her voice was reasonable and determined. Jamie closed his eyes.
May the Lord deliver me from women, he said between his teeth.
He opened his eyes and glared at her.
All right, he said. You're married. But you'll do it right before a priest. We'll find one in the Indies when we land. And until you've been blessed, Fergus doesna touch you, aye?
He turned a ferocious gaze on both of them.
Yes, me lord,
said Fergus, his features suffused with joy.
Merci beaucoup.
Miss Sally narrowed her eyes at Jamie, but seeing that he wasn't to be moved, she bowed her head demurely with a sidelong glance at me.
Yes, Daddy, she said.
The question of Fergus's elopement had at least distracted Jamie's mind temporarily from the motion of the ship, but the palliative effect didn't last. He held on grimly, nevertheless, turning greener by the moment, but refusing to leave the deck and go below, so long as the shore of Scotland was in sight.
I may never see it again, he said gloomily, when I tried to persuade him to go below and lie down.
He leaned heavily on the rail he had just been vomiting over, eyes resting longingly on the unprepossessing bleak coast behind us.
No, you'll see it, I said, with an unthinking surety. You're coming back. I don't know when, but I know you'll come back.
He turned his head to look up at me, puzzled. Then the ghost of a smile crossed his face.
You've seen my grief, he said softly, haven't you?
I hesitated, but he didn't seem upset, and I nodded.
It's all right, he said.
He closed his eyes, breathing heavily.
Don't tell me when, though, if you dinna mind.
I can't, I said. There weren't any dates on it. Just your name and mine.
Yours?
His eyes popped open. I nodded again, feeling my throat tighten at the memory of that granite slab. It had been what they call a marriage stone. A quarter circle carved to fit with another in a complete arch. I had, of course, seen only the one half. It had all your names on it. That's how I knew it was you. And underneath it said, Beloved Husband of Claire. At the time, I didn't see how. But now, of course, I do. He nodded slowly, absorbing it.
Aye, I see. I will. I suppose if I shall be in Scotland and still married to you, then maybe when doesn't matter so much.
He gave me a shadow of his usual grin and added wryly,
It also means we'll find young Ian safe. For I'll tell you, Sassenach, I will not set foot in Scotland again without him.
We'll find him, I said, with an assurance I didn't altogether feel. I put a hand on his shoulder and stood beside him, watching Scotland slowly recede in the distance. By the time evening set in, the rocks of Scotland had disappeared in the sea mists, and Jamie, chilled to the bone and pale as a sheet, suffered himself to be led below and put to bed. At this point, the unforeseen consequences of his ultimatum to Fergus became apparent. There were only two small private cabins besides the captain's. If Fergus and Miss Sally were forbidden to share one until their union was formally blessed, then clearly Jamie and Fergus would have to take one, and Miss Sally and I the other. It seemed destined to be a rough voyage in more ways than one. I had hoped that the sickness might ease if Jamie couldn't see the slow heave and fall of the horizon, but no such luck.
Again?
Said Fergus, sleepily rousing on one elbow in his berth in the middle of the night.
How can he? He has eaten nothing all day.
Tell him that, I said, trying to breathe through my mouth as I sidled toward the door, a basin in my hands, making my way with difficulty through the tiny, cramped quarters. The deck rose and fell beneath my unaccustomed feet, making it hard to keep my balance.
Hear me, lady. Allow me.
Fergus swung bare feet out of bed and stood up beside me, staggering and nearly bumping into me as he reached for the basin.
"You should go and sleep now, milady," he said, taking it from my hands. "I will see to him, be assured."
Well, the thought of my birth was undeniably tempting. It had been a long day.
"Go, Sassenach," Jamie said.
His face was a ghastly white, sheened with sweat in the dim light of